You remember when Lazarus was sick, and a messenger came to Jesus and his disciples, and they said, "Come quickly. Lazarus is sick, and you need to come." Well, Jesus waited 3 days. And in that delay, which seemed to be purposeful, he waited and waited. And by waiting, Lazarus didn't get the medical attention that he needed. He didn't have the healing hand of Jesus Christ there. And Lazarus died. And Jesus finally comes, but he came when it's already too late. Mary was attending to the body, and Martha, the sister, ran up to Jesus, and basically she said what you and I would all say: "Where were you? We called on you. You knew he was sick. We prayed. We prayed. You didn't answer. You didn't come. Where were you when my brother died?" In essence, she's somewhat saying, roundabout, it's your fault that he's dead. You could have stopped it. Where were you? You and I would ask the same question, I'm sure. If it was our brother that died, we would question God, knowing that he's sovereign. Where was he? Why did he allow this to happen? He could have prevented it from occurring. Where was God there in this tragic event? This happened to a man named John Sanders, who used to teach philosophy and religion at Notre Dame and now teaches philosophy and religion at Hendricks College here in Conway. When John Sanders was younger, his brother, I'm assuming it was his older brother, was tragically killed in a car accident, leaving John Sanders to wonder, where was God? Where were you, God? Coming from a Methodist background, one of his friends told John, "Well, God allowed your brother to die to draw you to him. God allowed your brother to die to work in your life, to save you." And John Sanders began to ponder, why would God allow my brother to die? And rejected that answer outright, because that would place God as the responsible party of the death of his brother, and he couldn't receive that. So he rejected that day, or months from that, he rejected the doctrine of divine sovereignty. Rejected it all out because he couldn't accept a God who could allow bad things to happen, tragic things to happen to people that he loved. And he becomes, and he is currently, the leading proponent of open theism. He's world renowned. Here in Conway, he's the leading proponent of open theism, which open theism is a belief that God is not sovereign. And in the process of accepting open theism, he began to say the prophecies of the Old Testament were only probable. They're good predictions, but they're not guarantees. Because if God could prophesy the future, then that would mean he has to be sovereign over the future. Thus, his prophecies are just God's plans that he wants to see happen if he can arrange it. But he himself is bound to the free will of man, so he doesn't know for certain what he may or might do. He wrote a book called The God Who Risks, that in creation he tied his hands, his power behind his back, so that man could have free will and do as they would choose to do. So he totally rejects the sovereignty of God, all because he couldn't deal with the concept of his brother's death being in the hands of a sovereign God. It is a hard dilemma. And I want you to think, if you were Martha, and it was your brother that died, and you prayed, you asked God for a healing, you asked God to come, and God delayed. He came, but he was a day too late. He was there, but Lazarus was already dead. Now, I know you've had some major things happen to your life, and it may have caused you to question your faith, or question God. Some of us, we begin to complain over a hangnail. I mean, it doesn't take much for us to go, God, you're not doing things right. God, where are you? Where are you in 2020? I mean, it seems like you've just left us. Where are you today? And you question God's sovereignty. You actually question, maybe in your mind, God's wisdom. That if you were God, you could do things a little bit better. That you could run things a little bit better, and you would have done this, you would have done that, and we wouldn't be in the predicament that we're in, because we would change things so much quicker. But God, he delays. He waits. And in the delay, in the waiting, or non-responding, things get worse. To the point that sometimes you and I, we begin to question, does God even hear us? Does God even listen to us? I've been talking to Joe Tigreen, and he says the hardest thing about the situation that he's in, he's a missionary that we've been supporting to Turkey. He's in his mid-30s, and he's got weeks to live, if not days. He says the hardest thing of dealing with his pending death, knowing that he could die any moment, all it takes is a wrong cough, is the fact that you prepare to die, and then you survive, then you have to prepare to die, and you think, this is the moment I'm going to die, and you survive, and it's ongoing preparing your heart for death, and then you don't die, and then you have to do it again and again every day. He says, I don't know if I'm going to live an hour or 2 weeks. He said, that's probably the hardest thing I'm dealing with right now. But we've been praying for Joe that God would heal him. And so far, God allowed his cancer just to grow. And even Joe says, right now, it seems like I'm prepared that God will not answer this. This will be something that will glorify him in another way. But where is God? Where is God when these things happen? Well, I believe Daniel chapter 8 gives us a little bit of help as we think about bad things and a sovereign God. Start with me in verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, this is the year 539 BC, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. And I saw in the vision, when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel, which is the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one come up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. And as I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal. And he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. And then the goat became exceedingly great. But when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns towards the four winds of the heaven. Out of the one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the glorious land. It grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of the hosts and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offerings was taken away from him, and in the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. And a host will be given over to together with the regular burnt offerings because of transgression, and it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary should be restored in its rightful state." When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai. And it called, "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." So he came near where I stood. And when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, "Understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end." And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand up. He said, "Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the ignorant nation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end." So here we see this vision. It speaks about the things that's going to happen before the end. And this is, in my mind, this is not talking about the end of the world. This is talking about the end of the Jewish economy, the end of the Old Testament period, the end of their, if you would, dispensation. What are going to be the things that happens before Christ comes the first time? And this gives us certain events that's going to happen. But what we see is God's judgment upon the nation of Israel. All these events are because of the transgression of Israel. This is Saul. We see this in verse 12. Because of their transgression, they went into Babylon and they went back into captivity with the Medes and the Persians, and ultimately subjected under the rule of Greece, then into the hands of the Romans. They never were truly liberated and truly never had their independence and autonomy and freedom until Christ comes and establishes a new kingdom. So this is judgment upon their sins. But in this judgment, we see one bad thing happening after another. Till we get to the point where we see that literally thousands of Jews were destroyed in the year 165 by the hands of a king, mentioned here as the little horn. But we see all this devastation, and the question we may want to ask is, where is God in all these events? Where is God as one bad thing happened after another? Where is God? Are these not God's people? Are these not the saints? Are these not the holy ones as they're referred to in this passage? Well, there are three things we learn about where God is when bad things happen to us. And as we see our world kind of crumble around us and we see our own country may be falling apart, where is God? Well, here are three things to consider. One, God is sovereign and very much present. He is sovereign even in the judgment of his people. We see this in all these foreign powers taking, if you would, the liberty and the freedom away from Israel and ruling them. Yeah, they were, after the destruction of Babylon, they were allowed to go back. Many of them went back. But though they went back and rebuilt their walls and their temples, their temple, they never truly gained their independence. Because as we see in verse 20, there was another empire that was to come. Look at verse 20. It says, "As for the ram that you saw with two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia." This is Cyrus and Darius. They were in league together, and they basically were a joint empire, and they became great. Verse 3 says, "I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns representing these two nations. Both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one come up last." The highest of the horns were the Persians. They were a little bit stronger and greater than the Medes. But nevertheless, they ruled together and they ruled over Israel. But in verse 21, we see that though this ram seemed to be reckless and no one could subdue it, there was a male goat that was finally able to do so. We see in verse 21, "And the goat is the king of Greece." That's Alexander the Great. "And the great horn between his eyes is the first king." I mean, it's not using Alexander's name, but this clearly can be no other than Alexander the Great. Verse 5 depicts Alexander this way. "As I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes." I mean, that horn represents Alexander. And this goat is able to fly across the earth so fast, it's not even touching the ground. Speaking about the swiftness in which Alexander conquered the world. He rose to power after his father died in 336. He was only 20 years old. And did you know, within 10 years, he had conquered the world. He'd gone as far as he knew to go into India. And after he conquered India, the reports are that he began to weep. He began to cry. Here he is. He's a 30-year-old, and he's conquered the world, and he's crying because there's no other place to conquer. I mean, who is this man that could basically take a massive army? Remember, they had to travel on foot and go all the way, basically from Athens all the way to India, conquering everything that lays before him. How was he able to do that within a short 10-year period? But it depicts the rise of Alexander and talks about how fast and swift he would move. We know how he did it because God prophesied it some 220 years before it happened. That God raised up Alexander and subdued the nations under his foot because God appointed the rise of Alexander. He sets up kings, he brings down kings, he is sovereign over the nations of the world. And that's, it's prophesied 220 years before it happened. We see in verse 6 that God prophesied Alexander's defeat of the Persians. Look at verse 6. "And he came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke the two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power." He's talking about the conquest of the Persians in 331. Alexander was only 25 years old, and he took down the greatest power of the world. And he was only 5 years in his reign. Again, it would only take 5 more years from then where he would conquer India. But even God not only prophesied that he would conquer the Persians, he conquered the whole known world, but God prophesied his death. Look at verse 8. "Then the great Then the goat became exceedingly great. But when he was strong, that is the height of his power. I mean, at the very apex of his accomplishments, he conquers the whole world. The great horn was broken. He says at the peak of his power, this great horn is going to be broken in two. And that's exactly what happened. 3 years later, on his way back, mainly they had no place else to conquer, and his troops were homesick. They wanted to go home. They'd been away for 10 years. And so he's marching back, and he's there in Babylon, which he was going to make Babylon his new center of power. He was going to make that his capital. And there in Babylon, at the age of 33, he died suddenly. In the apex of his power, he died, just as it was prophesied about him. Now, it also prophesied that after his death, four kingdoms would rise up in the place of Alexander. Look at verse 8, at the second part of verse 8. And instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns towards the four winds of the heaven. Verse 22, which gives us an interpretation. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others rose, four kingdoms shall rise from his nation, but not with his power. As Alexander lay dying in Babylon, they asked him, who is your successor? Who's going to take your place? And it is reported that his answer was, to the strongest. He only had an infant child that was in no place to rule. And so he said, to the strongest. Others say that he chose his leading general, the one that stood by his side, Perdiccas. But as you can imagine, Perdiccas, who was going to take over, he was assassinated that very year. And after the death of Alexander and the assassination of his general, it went into a 15 year of civil war and combat. The rest of his generals broke up and began to fight one another for 15 years. One of his generals, Cassander, he basically took over Macedonia in the west. He was Alexander's longtime friend and would order the execution of Alexander's mother, his wife Roxanne, and their infant son to secure his place upon the throne. Another general, Ptolemy, took over Egypt in the south. He took the corpse of Alexander and took it down into Egypt because there was a legend wherever the body of Alexander would lay to rest, that place would be the next place of power. He would end up ruling over Egypt, and his kingdom would last until 300 BC, until the death of, who's that lady that, Cleopatra. So his kingdom lasted all the way to Cleopatra in the 30 BC. Then another general, Antigonus, he ruled over Syria, which at the time ruled over Israel in the north. Then Seleucus ruled over Persia in the east. So basically, after the death of Alexander, the emperor divided into four kingdoms. But not only did God prophesy the division of the Grecian or the Macedonian empire, he prophesied this other king that would come. And in 175, Antiochus of Epiphanes. This is a prophecy that took place 365 years before it happened. Look at verse 9. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the glorious land. And then verse 23, if you jump down, here's some more commentary. And at the latter end of the kingdom, when the transgressors had reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. Antiochus was not likely to be a great king. In fact, he was a Roman prisoner a political prisoner, and it was his cousin that was in line to rule. But they did a prison exchange, and he wins his freedom. He comes back and commits somewhat of a treasonous act and kills his cousin's parents and his cousin's family and takes over. Some call him a madman, but he was one of the first kings that put on coins that he was the manifestation of God on earth. He claimed to have divine powers. And eventually is depicted here in this story as this little horn. And he began to seek to conquer the lands around him. It goes on to say in verse 23, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the glorious land. Or as verse 10 says, it grew great even to the host of heaven. And some of the hosts and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. See, there was much tension in Judah between the Hellenized Jews and the Orthodox Jews already. In Jerusalem, the Hellenization process had already started. And there was a conflict between the Hellenized Jews and the Orthodox Jews. And there was a priest named Jason who was appointed by Antiochus to take over. And he gained his position. At that time, the priest in Judah became basically the ruling leader in Judah. And he was not of Levi, but of a Benjamite. He was a Benjamite. And he got his position as high priest because he promised Antiochus a great sum of money from the treasury of the temple to have his position. But it became him and his brother begin to come fight for this position. And both of them were evil men, by the way. And Jason had set up a gymnasium. And they begin to have sports, which was appalling to the Jews at the time because they did these sports and these athletic events without clothes. And the Jews were appalled by the kind of the barbaric activities that was going on in the gym. And the high priest left off sacrificing and left off their priestly duties to entertain and to basically Hellenize the people. Well, Antiochus went down to the south to try to conquer Egypt. In fact, he did conquer Egypt, other than the fact that the Egyptians were in allegiance to Rome, and Rome basically threatened to come in to play. And so he left off Egypt. And after leaving off Egypt, knowing that he could do no more in Egypt because Rome was behind them, backing them, he goes and throws his fury upon Judah. And he goes into Judah and basically defiles the temple and wreaks havoc. And this is around 168 BC. In all these things are prophesied by God and given to Daniel many, many years before the events took place. Now, before we get into the second point, what I want you to notice about this is notice that these are accurate prophecies that could not have happened if God wasn't involved in the events of these matters. So when you're reading world history and you're reading history, know that you're reading the plans of God as they're being executed. Knowing that there's not one person raised up or brought down that God hasn't appointed, that God is in control. And that should cause us to relax and to rest as we look at the political tension that our nation is in. No matter who gets in the office, and I personally think it's still up to debate of who's going to be in there. But we don't have to sit and fret about who it's going to be, because we know that it's God who will determine who is our leader and who is our president. He raised up Alexander, he raised up Antiochus, he raised up Darius, he raised up Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. He raised up all these people. Before they were born, God knew who they were and raised them up for his very purposes. But this should give us real comfort when we think about the tragedies. Because these prophecies are not just glorious prophecies of great things. These are prophecies of terrible events through these men that would happen upon the people of God. These are hard truths. These are not easy truths to receive. And so we should take comfort in the fact that your problems or the death of a loved one or the hardest thing that you're going through or been through, that it wasn't an accident. Now, we may want to blame God, but I would rather have a God who is in control over the bad things. Because if he's in control, as we'll see later, there is a purpose for it. There's a reason for it. But there's nothing more disturbing to think that something bad happened and it was for no good reason. There's nothing more hard to deal with is to think that it is a wasted pain, pointless sorrow. There's no pointless grief. When Lazarus died, there was a reason to it. There's a reason for the Lord's delay. He wasn't late. He was right on time. He came when he intended to come. We can rest in the sovereignty of God. We may not understand why God does what he does. We may not be able to put all the pieces together in our mind and solve all the riddles that we may have. But we can do this. Trust the one who can. We can trust the one who knows all things and is sovereign and is in control. And I am thankful that we have a God who is in control of the events of the world history. So that's where God is. Secondly, God is also afflicted with the affliction of his people. He said, where God is, he's up there and he's just arbitrarily organizing things and he doesn't care. He's not sorrowful. He's not like you and I that have emotions, and he's kind of in this all temporal, you know, apathetic state. He's just a sovereign God that does what he wants. He doesn't care how you feel, or he's not affected how you feel. That's not our God. When you're crying, God feels it too. And he's afflicted with the affliction of his people. Now, he may be sovereign over it, but he endures the grief with you and I. We see this in the middle of this chapter. It's pretty glorious. We see the fact that Antiochus basically was so mad. There's a reason they called him the mad one. So mad. He claimed to be God manifested on earth, that he was willing to attack God. Look at verse 11. It, talking about the little horn, it, the little horn, Antiochus, became great, even as great as the prince of the host. He's talking about the Lord Jesus, or the second person of the Trinity, or God himself, the prince of the host. Now, obviously we know Antiochus is not as great as God. But Antiochus thought he was. He thought he was going to take over Judah and to trample underfoot the worship of God. And that he did. However, God views an attack upon his worship as an attack upon himself. Look at verse 11, the second part. And the regular burnt offerings was taken away from him, talking about the prince of hosts, and the palace of his sanctuary was overthrown. Now, the temple was the place where God dwells. This is the place where he receives worship. This is his holy place. This is the place of God. And Antiochus came in and sought to defile that very palace and house of the living God. Who does he think he is? You realize this verse is saying he's attacking me, God says. You do this to my worship, I take that offense to me. And that's why we as a church need to be very careful how we worship God. Because God views his worship as he views himself. If you attack his worship, if you defile his worship, you're defiling the living God. And it's appalling what some churches do in the name of Jesus. But in 2 Maccabees chapter 5, a historical account, which is most historians view this as very accurate, writes about this event. When these things happenings were reported to the king, he thought that Judah was in revolt, raging, this is Antiochus, raging like a wild animal. He set out from Egypt and took Jerusalem by storm. He ordered his soldiers to cut down without mercy those whom they met and to slay those who took refuge in their houses. And there was a massacre of young and old, killing of women and children, a slaughter of young women and infants. In the space of 3 days, 80,000 were lost, 40,000 meeting a violent death, and the same number being sold into slavery. Not satisfied with this, the king dared to enter into the holiest temple in the world. The high priest, that traitor both to the laws and to his country, served as a guide. Antiochus became puffed up in his spirit, not realizing it was because of the sins of the city's inhabitants that the sovereign Lord was angry for a little while. Hence, the disregard of the place. We see, not only does God say, when you attack my worship, you attack me. We see in verse 12, if you attack my people, you attack me. Verse 12 says, and a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offerings because of transgression. Then verse 24 says, his power shall be great, but not by his own power, and he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. Now, these people who are the saints are the Israelites who worship God. These are the Orthodox Jews that are trying to worship God as God has prescribed. But Antiochus is cutting them down. He's warring against them. And verse 25 says, by his cunning he shall make discreet prosper under his hand, and he, in his own mind, he shall become great. And without warning he shall destroy many. And he shall even rise up against the prince of princes. So this is telling us he's actually not as great as he thinks he is. He's not near as great as the prince of hosts. He's not as great as God, but he thinks he is. He thinks he's in, you know, he can't be stopped. He's invincible. But God views an attack upon his people as an attack upon himself. And we see in verse 12, God views an attack upon the truth as an attack upon himself. Verse 12 says, and a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offerings because of transgression. And it, the little horn, will throw truth to the ground and it will act and prosper. I mean, as we'll see, for 6 years, a little over 6 years, the city of Jerusalem was in dismay. There was no offerings. There's no morning or evening offerings. There's no worship. The people of God were trampled underfoot. All because this king thought he could face down God and win. But the point we need to see is when any of God's people are suffering, are attacked, are persecuted, God himself views that he's being attacked, persecuted. You can't touch the truth, the worship of God, the truth of God, the people of God, without God taking offense, without God being angry about it. You see, it is God that is being attacked here. 2 Maccabees 6 goes on to explain more detail of what went on. It says, not long after this, the king sent an Athenian senator to force the Jews to abandon the laws of their ancestors and to live no longer by the laws of God, also to profane the temple in Jerusalem and dedicate it to Olympian Zeus, the one on the Mount Gerizim, to Zeus, the host of the strangers, as the local inhabitants want to be. This was a harsh and utterly intolerable evil. The Gentiles filled the temple with debauchery and rivalry, and they amused themselves with prostitutes. It goes on, and I won't read it, but it goes on to talk about how the temple was made into a brothel. And ungodly acts were taking place within the very holy places. They also brought forbidden things into the temple so that the altar was covered with abominable offerings prohibited by the laws. No one could keep the Sabbath or celebrate the traditional feast, not even admit to being a Jew. It is reported that two people during this time, two women circumcised their infants, and those two women were slaughtered and put on poles with their children for such an act. I mean, this was a horrible, horrible time in the history of Israel. For these 6 years, it was just maddening. And you may think, where is God? Is this not his people? Is this not his temple? Is this not his worship? Is this not God? And we learn in the text it's because of their own transgression, the transgression of Israel, that God did this. But you also see that God's mad about it. And he's taking offense at it. So we can see somewhat the complexity of the story. We see God's sovereignty in judging Israel for their sins, but we also see that God raised up Antiochus for this very purpose. But God viewed Antiochus' attack on Judah as an attack upon himself. Where is God when bad things happen to his people? He's right next to them. He's right next to you when you're peering into the casket of your loved one. He hasn't left you or forsaken you. You know, when Jesus came back, he knew what he was going to do. When he came and saw Martha and Mary, what does it say about Jesus? He could have, hey, I know I'm about to raise this man from the dead. He could have said that, right? He could be thinking, hey, this is not going to be bad. He could be happy. He could act like nothing's wrong because he knows the end of the story. But that's not what happens. He looked at the grief of these two sisters and he sat next to them and wept with them. And no matter what you're going through or what you've been through, and you may say, well, I know God is sovereign, but I can tell you this. He hates grief and he hates sin and he hates death and he hates these things and he weeps with you. So much does he weep with you, he sent his own son into this cursed, awful, evil world to endure the pain. And the Lord knows what it feels like to endure awful things. And he can identify with you as a high priest. He can know what you're going through because he himself went through it. And he's the only one that didn't deserve to go through the trials of life. So where is God when bad things happen? I'm telling you, he's right next to you. And he takes offense when anything bad happens to his people. The third point we see here at the end, this is very glorious, and I love how these stories always come out triumphantly. You know, we know the end of the story. Lazarus comes out of the grave. I mean, it was a glorious thing. In fact, there's not so much joy if you didn't have grief. There's just, it wouldn't be as joyous. If you watch a movie, you know, if you watch most all good movies, the grief or the trial doesn't happen halfway through. It happens almost at the very end. You know, 80% of the movie's gone, and then the worst thing happens about 80 to 90% of the movie, right? It's towards the end that it gets really, really, really bad. But that's because it makes that glorious moment all the better. When victory happens, it's like, man, how did that happen? It came out of nowhere. Well, they're just copying God's way of doing things. Things come great when things get really bad. Truly, there is light after darkness. Where is God? Well, he has a plan because he's got a glorious plan to vindicate himself and to vindicate his people. We see God is vindicated in the judgment of his people. Look at verse 13. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is this vision concerning the regular burnt offerings, the transgressions that make desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and the host of the to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." Do the math, that's 6 years and 3.5 months. It's just going to be a short period, not indefinitely. Verse 25, again, is the angelic commentary. It says, "By his coming he shall make desolate prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great. Without warning he shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken but by no human hand." Not only does it speak of the rise of Antiochus, it speaks of his unexpected death. He didn't die of human hands. He died of a great disease caused by God. He suddenly died in 164, this madman who claimed to be God manifested on earth. This madman who war against God and the temple and the people of God, caused all this havoc. He suddenly died unexpectedly. It is reported about his death in 2 Maccabees chapter 9. "But the all-seeing Lord, the God of Israel, struck him with an incurable and invisible blow. As soon as he stopped speaking, he was seized with a pain in his bowels, for which there was no relief, and with sharp internal tortures, and that very justly, for he had tortured the bowels of others with many and strange inflictions. Yet he did not in any way stop his insolence, but was even more filled with arrogance, breathing fire in his rage against the Jews and giving orders to drive even faster. And so it came about that he fell out of his chariot as it was rushing along, and he fell so hard as to torture every limb of his body. Thus he was only a little while before he had thought in his superhuman arrogance that he could command the waves in the sea, and had imagined that he could weigh the high mountains in a balance, was brought down to the earth and carried in a little, making the power of God manifest to all. And so the ungodly man's body swarmed with worms. And while he was still living in anguish and pain, his flesh rotted away. And because of the stench, the whole army felt revulsion at his decay." I mean, this man attacked God, and God humbled him before the world. God won't have those who afflict God's people win victorious at the end. God will have the last laugh. You see, God will be vindicated, and he will turn evil into good. And this is why Jesus delayed coming to Lazarus. He delayed on purpose. He says, because this sickness is not unto death. It's for the glory of God. I can promise you, I don't know if you can understand it now. I don't know if you could be able to go, it makes sense to me in this very moment. You may not be able to connect the dots now, but you can trust the living word and know that whatever you've been through or are going through, it's not unto death. It may lead to temporal death, but that's not the end of the story. Every loved one that has gone on to be with the Lord will rise again. It'll be a glorious day. Every person who attacked the people of God will be put to an awful death. We learned last week that we win. We see in this week that God is sovereign over all these bad things, but I trust you, we can trust God. Though they may appear bad, it all ends well. This is where God is when bad things happen. Let's go to the Lord in prayer.